folks, and welcome or welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast was brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis, a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for the past 2 decades, 8 years of which he's been actively buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in the city on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So his company has a dedicated loan officer in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions. So you're probably already aware that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or if you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on emil.gorgis, that's E-M-I-L dot G-O-R-G-E-E-S, emil.gorgis at tokyorealty.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so we're back with our JREP panel this week, or at least most of it. And this time we talk a bit more about those dirt cheap ski resort properties. Who can use those and for what purposes? How to do due diligence on them? How do renovations and repairs work there? From which we segue into the broader topic of reserve funds for renovations and repairs. The difference in mentality and mindset between buildings and areas that are mostly investor-owned versus mostly owner-occupied-owned. Shopping streets, or shotengais as they're called here, and also a bit about loans. So multiple loans, how exactly is borrowing and repayment capacity calculated, how are interest rates calculated, and the factors that affect all of that. So the age of the borrower, their family status, length and type of employment, monthly annual income and so forth, existing debts as well. And then at the very end, we talk about our new company, Nippon Bridge, and the services that it offers, which is to help foreign investors buy into and operate Japanese franchise businesses. And also we're going to be providing affordable relocation support services. I've mentioned this a few times in the past already, and you can soon expect to hear a lot more about it. But for now, just giving you a sneak preview of what we're all about. So really good discussion there. Hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you again on the other side.
And we're back. Japan Real Estate Experts panel, JREP.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Did you miss us? Well, by the time we publish this, it might be like three of them just prior to that. So they're not even going to know how long we haven't been getting together.
How long has it been? I think last week I couldn't come on. Maybe the week before or the week before that.
Yeah, no, but I published them a couple of months later, and then I squeeze other episodes in between, so it takes a bit of time. So yeah, short intros, Tracy.
So yes, I'm Tracy. I am the Minpaku short-term rental expert. I've been doing short-term rentals in Tokyo for 10 years, and I have a Minpaku Kandi license, and also I have a hotel license, and I have various house licenses. So I'm property manager. I look after people's properties who are living overseas, for example, or investments. So that's me.
Emil?
Ziv, yourself. Oh, okay.
Me? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Ziv.
Yep. So I'm Ziv. I'm a co-founding partner, and I've been running Nippon Tradings International for the last 10 years as well. And what we do is we help investors and holiday home shoppers mainly, but basically anyone who wants to buy any kind of real estate in Japan. We help them research, due diligence, negotiate, purchase, manage, and sell their properties, whether they're in Japan or without. So our thing is we can do everything for people, for them to be completely remote if they want, or they can hire us for just research, consultation, and facilitation of the purchase, and then they can manage on their own. Anything that they want. Emil.
Sure. And I'm a real estate agent here based in Tokyo. I help usually to English speaking or foreign families that are long-term residents in Japan purchase their first home. So we do the very standard, you know, Japanese home loans, the 100% financing or 105% financing at 0.5% interest rate for your personal home in Tokyo. So my most recent clients, they are about 4 months, I think 4 months pregnant, and they just bought a brand new house out in, where is it? Near Tamagawa area. So yeah, they've got a brand new house. It should be completed April, and they'll be moving in early May.
Just bought a new house.
Settlement day. My clients.
Oh right.
So my most recent clients are it's a married couple and they are 4 months pregnant.
Oh right.
So they need to move a bit quickly. pregnant couple. So it's a Japanese wife with an English husband.
Tamagawa.
Yeah, then near that side of town.
Nice.
You mentioned first house, but I'm guessing people come to you for upgrade on their house to sell an old one.
It's funny. So the two active ones I have right now, like last week, one is that young family who are 6 months, 4 months pregnant, and the other one is he's a gentleman who bought a mansion, like an apartment. It's a mansion. In Setagaya-ku near Sangenjaya, about 3 years ago, 2019, he bought it, and since then he got married a little bit after, like maybe a year afterwards or 2 years after he got married, and just a few months ago he sent me another message saying, "Look, we're outgrowing our 2LDK mansion, and we've got a few dogs now as well. We got three little dogs. We need a house. We need a bigger place." So we're looking around and they're both a foreign couple. Neither are Japanese, but the husband has a permanent residency. And yes, we looked at some places, and we just found a house for them as well, down near sort of towards the Tamagawa area, like it's in just near Setagaya-ku, the next Komaya ward, Komayashi. It's a used property, but it's fantastic. It's 10 years old. It's made by a Hable House, which is a steel structure. It's a brand name automated house. Steel structure, so the roof can be flat. It doesn't need the triangle roof. So the whole rooftop is a rooftop. And it has a garden and like a double car park driveway. Great for their dogs. So it's fantastic. So we just put the offer in it and it got accepted. And now we're doing all the bank paperwork. So yeah, and we're in the process of selling his previous, his first mansion. In terms of what you mentioned, upgrade, yeah, we're doing that right now. Just people upgrading there in their next stage of life. So we're doing that. So yeah,
When you do these kind of deals, you usually get two for the price of one kind of thing, right? Because then, like you said, they need to sell the old house too.
Yeah, to be honest, yes, that is the case, but they don't always sell it. Sometimes I'll rent it out depending on their situation. So yeah, we can also manage the full rental management of it. And generally, we try to do that. We don't make as much money. We make more commission on sale than rental management.
Yeah,
of course. But I personally genuinely believe if you can keep your old one as an investment and rent it out, and you still have enough borrowing capacity to buy a second one, the rental you get on the first property will more than cover the mortgage. So why should you get rid of that? So that's the ideal scenario for the clients. And we like doing that because it's not about how much money we can get. It's what's the best situation the client can be in, the most comfortable and most financially beneficial. But in his case, he doesn't want to, he can't borrow as much. He only bought it 3 years ago, right? So basically, he hasn't paid off enough of it to extend out an extra loan for the new property. And the new property is substantially more because his situation has changed. His family size has grown. So he needs a bigger, more expensive place. So he has to get rid of the first one.
I have two questions. I have two follow-up questions to this. First of all, if you have, if you do have an existing property, what's the usual amount of principal that you will have had to have paid off before they'll extend the loan, or does that not work like that?
It doesn't work like that, but it's a good question. So rather, how does a second loan work? If you have one, how much do they loan it? Yeah, second house loan, or just extending. How much can you borrow if you've already got an existing loan? And it's actually quite straightforward. What they look at is how much can you borrow in total based on your income?
Right.
What is your
total balance, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, up until, it doesn't really matter until 45 years old.
Yeah, I'm 50, right?
We're all
older than 45.
Well, yeah. So, and that's, when I say it doesn't matter, it's just quite a mathematical calculation. The loan, in general, when we say that, like the numbers I'm going to give you, it's based on a 35-year loan term. So for the most part, you can borrow about 7 to 8 times your annual income based on a 35-year loan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Once you... but the condition is the maximum is 35 years or it must be paid off by your 80th birthday.
Right.
So once you turn 45, the loan term can only be 34 years, 33 years, 32 as you get older. So, but how do they calculate your max borrowing amount? I say seven times your annual income, but it's actually, you shouldn't repay annually more than 1/3 of your income to the mortgage. Beyond that, they think you're going to be in financial stress. Okay? So let's say the most you can borrow is based on a 200,000 yen mortgage repayment. Okay? If you can pay 200,000 yen a month, the bank thinks 200,000 yen a month is the most you can pay comfortably without being in financial stress. 200,000 yen based on the current interest rates over 35 years or 420 repayment periods, 420 months, is... about 70 million yen, nanasemai yen.
Mm-hmm.
Comes to about 200,000 yen a month. Now, if you're, you know, 49 years old or 50 years old, you can only do a 30-year mortgage repayment. Your borrowing capacity, your repayment capacity is still 200,000 yen a month. But 200,000 yen a month, no longer over 35 years, only over 30 years. So that's not as much. And that's how they look at it. Okay, it's based on your repayment. So if you have another loan, a good example, let's forget about another house loan. Let's look at a car loan. You have another car loan, even if it's a 3-year car loan. If you're paying 50,000 yen a month for that car loan, the bank will say the most you can pay per month is 200,000 yen.
But you already have
a 50,000 yen monthly obligation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to loan you based on 150,000 yen repayment for the 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, hey, my car is only 3 million yen. It's not going to be paid off in 3 years. I say, yeah, but we're looking at your current monthly obligations. So if you want, pay that loan off, pay that car loan off. And then all of a sudden your obligations will, you know, are wiped and you can now borrow based on 200,000 yen annual repayments. So now when you look at, and this is relevant because to your question before was how much principal do you have to have paid down?
Mm-hmm.
That's the wrong way of looking at it. Let's say you bought a 50 million yen property and you only have, I'll stick with 70 million. A 70 million yen property, you're paying 200,000 yen a month. Maybe there's only 5 years left in the loan term. You bought it 30 years ago. There's only 5 years left. And so there's only, you know, 6 million yen, 7 million yen left in mortgage repayments,
mm-hmm,
on your 70 million yen property. There's not much left. But your monthly obligations are still 200,000 yen a month. Your monthly outgoing is based on a 70 million yen loan, even though there's not that much being borrowed from it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the bank is going to say, well, you're currently paying off a 70 million yen equivalent mortgage. So you're already fully extended.
So as long as you're paying those 200,000 yen a month, you can't borrow more because you can't repay more.
Precisely.
Okay.
So what, depending on how long you've had it, not how much is remaining of the balance that you need to pay. It's what's the monthly outgoings. That's why a car loan or other kind of short-term loans is a good example, because if you're paying 50,000 yen a month for the car loan, even if it's just a 3 million yen car or 4 million yen car, it's going to impact your mortgage, your borrowing capacity by about 30 million yen. So $300,000, right, is less than what you can borrow. So
Oh, we've lost him.
Hold on. So, yeah.
He's completely gone.
Not with us.
Not with us. Well, I have another follow-up question for him.
He's been telling too many state secrets. They cut him off.
Yeah. But I have a question for you. I'm the question girl today.
Go for it.
We'll let him in when he comes back in. But so my question to you, my question is, I've been sniffing around these ski village places again, Ziv. I keep looking at them, and I don't know, what is your, you know, the people that I've been talking to, the management company was basically saying, if you buy it as a company, and I have a company, yes, so we'll come back to you in a minute, Emil. If I buy it as a company, then even though I can't list it on Airbnb, they still tell me that I'll be able to list it, have other people visit in terms of like a membership club or a private members club.
It's really dependent on the resort. So all of these properties that you're looking at, most likely, even if they're separate, like standalone villas, they're most likely within resort grounds.
Correct. Yes. And there's a fairly kept hefty kandihi and a fairly, yeah. but there is some, you know, there is some common, you know, there's some common things that you can use. There's like a bath, and there's a, you know, ski lockers and all sorts of things that are.
Yeah, so it really depends on the resort. All of them are generally very anti-rentals. Like if you actually want to rent it out, it's almost always going to be a strict no. But some of them do allow your personal friends and family acquaintances to use the property, even if you're not there.
Well, they said to me that they were okay with having a like a private members club. So because if you buy it as a company, then you can let other company, you know, they didn't say staff. It was a club, and it's like you can have a club, members can come and use it. I was like, okay, that means that I'll just list it on my website and I'll have my clients book it. They don't want it listed on Airbnb. I get that. You're not going to get a Minpaku license. Yeah.
I haven't heard about this particular way of putting it, but I think it's a kind of a workaround that they found out, right? So if I'm an individual owner of one of these properties and I can let my friends and family, well, if I'm a company owner, then I can let members of my company use it, you know, staffers, club members, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, I'll look into that some more, because if that's the case, I'm actually keen to, you know, for my own weekender and for my own stuff as well. But if I can make that not a cost center, it wouldn't be so much of a profit center either. It would be more of a lifestyle profit center.
Like pay for itself kind of thing.
Pay for itself type of thing. And I recognize there's going to be no capital gain. And there's, you know, because there is a fairly hefty kandihi here. You know, you're my aunt, like, you know, 40,000.
300 bucks. Ooh. Oh, 40,000. Okay.
40,000 a month. But, you know, like I said, there's a nice bath. Like, you know, they've got to use, and I don't know the other things to consider, like, you know, the body corporate things that I'll have to do some due diligence on, you know, what.
Just bear in mind.
What repairs need to be doing.
Two things you want to look at. Number one, agents are agents, right? So, I mean, Emil and people like him notwithstanding, most of the agents will say that it's doable, even if it's theoretically doable, just to make the sale.
This was the kanri.
If this was the kanri, not a problem. So that's what I was going to say. As long as you get information directly from the kanri saying that that's doable, then that's doable. I mean, they're the ones calling the shots.
It wasn't a real estate agent, because I was actually going to go and hire you to then broker the sale for me, because I just you
know. Yeah. So that's definitely doable. If the country says it's okay, then it's okay. I mean, look, the owners might vote in the future to change that, but at the moment it's doable.
Okay.
The other thing is to the same sort of due diligence that you're going to be doing on any kind of property that's managed by a country, you want to do on this one as well. So you want to see how much they've, because they're collecting, like you're saying, hefty monthly fees.
But I don't know how much is in the sinking fund, you know. For
that's
like
it. That's what I mean.
So you need the repair fund and all that.
You need to find out how much is in the sinking fund, and also the history and plans of what they have been using it for, or what and what they're planning to use it for.
And then how, and then what things they've got scheduled in the future, and what is the budget for that, and what's going to likely, how much the owners are going to have to put in their pocket to cover those. Yeah.
If they have that. So if they don't have a renovation plan or a maintenance plan for the next 10 years, that's not necessarily mismanagement. It just might mean that they've recently done stuff. So there's nothing urgent that needs to be done. So they haven't actually made a plan yet. So that's okay.
Do you have those terms in Japanese somewhere on your website, or that you, that, this is something that I'll have to hire you to do to give me
not
that
on a website, but I have been sending them back and forth via email to some people, so I'll dig them up for you.
Chōki shūzen and keikaku.
Yeah, I'm not gonna write that down. I need you have such a good like memory for all of these, like, you know, standard.
Yeah, he's amazing.
You know, five kanji jukugo. Like, you know, I don't know those words off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah. So just that's an easy one, right? Because chōki means long term. Okay, shūzen is repair, and keikaku is plan. So long term repair plan. It's basically the English direct translation. So it's nothing weird.
You sound like my son now. Like, Dad, this kanji is so easy.
It's so easy. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's a font.
But so I don't know how it is with the small investments that you work with, but what I, for some home loans, home mortgages, the bank won't give you finance if they're building does not have a long-term repair plan.
It's not going to be it'll be a cash purchase.
But what this also means is if the management company doesn't, like, I it's almost standard for a well-managed company, maybe some of the properties you're looking at, they're smaller and they're more regional. But in Tokyo, when, you know, prices are between like $500,000 to $1 million for mansions that people are buying, and this is something you expect. If they don't have the long-term plan, then that's quite a negative idea. It's like, wow, okay, are you guys going to manage it? And how well is it going to be managed? And are the owners even in agreement?
Oh, he's gone again. Oh my goodness. The phone must be ringing. So anyway, I don't think he's realizing that what we're talking about are these ski resorts, and that's something that's going to be nice and clickbaity for you for this episode, because that's because the prices that I'm looking at for a two bedroom or a three bedroom apartment, we're looking at under $10,000.
Yep. That's because the people that own it don't want to keep paying $400 a month if they're not using it, right?
But as long as I don't have to pay any back in arrears, then that's what would be good. So actually, Emil,
sorry about that.
That's all right. What we're talking about are these under $10,000 apartments, 2LDK, 3LDK, okay, that are in ski resorts with a fairly hefty kanri. And like I said to Ziv just before, he can actually use this as a clickbaity thing for him for this video.
Because under $10,000, that sounds like Matt's $1 properties.
$1 property. No, yeah. But I mean, they're out there, and I know people who have them, and they're quite happy with their purchase because it's a lifestyle thing. They're able to go and use it on weekends, and they're able to keep their ski stuff there. What I'm looking at is like, maybe I'm buying in a building where I've got a couple of friends who also have places in there. So we can go away together, and it's still cheaper than even booking a booking a villa up in like Hokkaido once a year, and it's your own place. So that's always sits well.
Yeah. So the thing is with the monthly, the reserve funds and the renovation history and the renovation plan, if the reserve fund is completely depleted and nothing recent was done and nothing, you know, immediate upcoming, that means that they'll definitely have to jack up fees when they do need to do it. So that 400 could suddenly turn into 600. That's one thing.
Or it'll be like a once-off, like, Like, we need
everyone pay $2,000 right now.
Kind everyone of pays $2,000 right now. Yeah, exactly.
So we want to avoid that. And the other thing is that even if you're, because some of these resorts are actually based around like a central building with facilities and then little villas all around them, right? Like with on their own little land plots. So in those cases, even though there's not, you know, there's not, there's no structural maintenance taken out of the reserve fund to cater for your own villa, still you want people to be able to use the main facilities if they suddenly, and we have had buildings where, you know, they have a sauna, they have a spa, they have all of these things like a gym, but they're slowly just closing it off and stopping giving people access to them because they just don't have the funds to keep maintaining them, right? So,
and you would be able to do the due diligence. So have you, you've done a few of these before, right?
That's part and parcel of every resort condo or resort or normal condo that we facilitate. Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, I'll talk to you a bit about more about that offline.
So I want to add to that bit about it because it's relevant for people looking at this part of the general due diligence for any kind of building purchase. And maybe it's more, it needs to be more thorough for your own personal property or the more expensive properties. And you can get away with not worrying so much if it's maybe just a cheaper investment. But the things that people should look at, that long-term management plan. So the main one is building maintenance, long-term building maintenance, the condition of the building, and the because you're paying for maintenance costs, right? And also the how the other owners are going to contribute, right? Should there be a shortfall? And so how it works is a long-term maintenance, the long-term building maintenance plan for, you know, building like most mansions that I sell will have, you know, like let's say the next 35, 40 or 50 years. I'll say, and it's basically like an Excel sheet. And it says from when the building was built up until for the next 50 years. So let's say it's a 15-year-old building. We'll still show the next 30 years or so, 35 years. This year, we're doing all the pipe cleaning. This is the expected budget. Next year, this is we're going to redo the lobby, the entrance, yeah, the entrance lobby. Yeah, oh, just it's in, just ongoing, ordinary ongoing maintenance tasks. And every about 10 to 15 years is when they do the it's called Daikibo Shuzen. It's a large scale repair and maintenance, and that's the one that costs several hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? Like tens of millions of yen. And that's where you see the scaffolding go up all around the building, and they do all the big exterior work. It takes maybe, you know, 6 months to 12 months.
Yeah.
All the exterior sort of cleaning and maintenance, all the waterproofing, all that sort of stuff.
And the roof.
That's waterproofing,
yeah. Yeah, and the roof, yeah. Exactly. And that's the big one. That's the big one. So even when clients are looking, because it's noisy and inconvenient for 6 to 12 months, that's the one that when you're looking at building, and actually on the, when you're doing the purchase, it will actually say like important notes. That there is in 1 or 2 years time where it's going to schedule the large scale repair. Okay. And you're like, some people are like, ooh, you know what? I don't want to live through that. Like, it's a family home and I'm just having a baby. I can't get a place. And for the next 12 months, it'd be noisy. And on the flip side, if it was just done 2 years ago, they also advertise that the big repair was done 2 years ago. So, you know, it's one, it's sort of, it's tidy and modern and clean. And you're not going to have to worry about it for another decade that you're going to have to put up with that noise. But when you look at the chart that they have, it will actually say for each year what the budget is. And then based on the current repairs, like the current situation, this is the graph of the budget of the pool of funds that they have based on the monthly contributions from all the managers. And often it'll say, you know, when you get a place that's 15 or 20 years old, or say, okay, this is where we are right now. And then, but we're not going to see meet the forecast moving forward. We need to adjust the price. This price option A, which is a 2,000 yen increase, price option B, which is a 4,000 increase, and price option C, which is like maybe 6,000 yen monthly increase, or the current go to. And you see the line drawn out on the graph versus actual budget required. And the owners will vote on option A, B, or C. Okay, or they may disagree and stay on the current path. And so sometimes we see a property and they'll actually say, the owners have agreed in the next 3 years to increase 1,000 yen and then another 500 yen, another 500 yen after that. So it's going to be up to 2,000 yen increase on the repair fund repayments over the next 2 years. That's really good. It means the owners have agreed to these changes. It's already been done. And the forecast rate means the sinking fund will have budget for the next 30 years. You're going to meet all the forecast stuff. That's why it's really important. Because what happens if you don't have enough money? There are two scenarios, or the three scenarios. One, let's say, you know, for maintenance, it needs to be done, but the owners didn't vote, didn't agree. There's not enough savings. They can either get a bank loan. The owners need to agree to get a bank loan, and they'll borrow, you know, a few $100,000, or if it's elevator repair, something happens with elevator. Often the elevator repair company can arrange the financing, and the building needs to borrow $400,000. And they say, okay, in addition to this, to make up for this, the owners need to pay this much extra, or they need to pay like every month, or they need to pay a lump sum of 300,000 yen each. And that's fine if the owners agree to it. So sometimes if there's on the building documents, if it says the building has a loan, and this is how much the owners are paying to pay off that mortgage anyway, pay off that loan for the repair that needed to be done, that's not a bad thing. It means all the owners are in agreement, they've got the repair done, and they're paying for it. But what happens is if they don't come to agreement, the repair doesn't get done, it falls into a state of disrepair. Okay, I've had one building, it was an old mansion, and it was on leased land. It was like 45 years old, and water was coming in through the windows. The person who owned the property they wanted to sell it, and you know, water would come in through the windows, but they can't change the wind. They're not able to change the windows. The building management doesn't want to do stuff about it, or because the owners don't want to agree to it, because half the building owners want to tear it down and repair, and rebuild. The other ones don't want to. And there's just that conflict. And because it's on leased land, there's different, I think the lease holder as well is starting to buy up a lot of these properties as well, so they can tear it down. There's a lot going on, but when you just look at it, I went to visit it, and although it's nice, high view, the outside of the building was crap. The elevator was terrible. The hall hadn't been updated for so long. And because there's just disputes and disagreements, when you don't have, that building did not have a long-term repair plan, right? But when there is one in place, the building tends to be a lot tidier, a lot easier to finance, a lot easier to resell. And just living there, like you talk about lifestyle, Tracy, like, you know, you're buying it for the lifestyle and comfort and holiday. But when you have these management headaches, and it's not just you can't choose the repair. That's a problem. It's you have to come to an agreement with a bunch of other holiday owners who may not even live in the country, who don't really care, right? That are doing it. And maybe they don't want to pay more, or maybe they're not even paying the funds.
We interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say this. We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, or if you just need summer quiet to hide away from the world. So they offer a variety of options for families, for corporate relocations, or simply if you're transitioning between homes in Tokyo. Now, the properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They've got fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, a fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but long-term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profits, or a holiday home that you want rented out when not in use via short-term stays, drop them a line today See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth your visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at emil.gorgies, G-O-R-G-E-E-S, at tokyorealty.jp.
Yeah, I'll add just a couple of small caveats on that. Number one, depending on the building management company as well, the building management company, so the owner union will nominate and hire a building management company to take care of all of these plans and renovations and recommendations and so forth. Some of the building management companies and some of even the developers that build these from the get-go, sometimes they have a policy. Like, for example, I think it was Daya Palace, I think, that we've worked with. We purchased properties by that developer and building management company a few times. They have a policy of leaving the monthly fees as low as possible for as long as possible. So they actually, whenever there is a renovation that needs to be done, by default, they'll take a loan out. Like, they want to leave the fees as low as possible for as long as possible for all the owners. And when it's time to renovate, they'll take a loan and then they'll raise the fees.
Money's so cheap though here though, right? Like, you know, when, you know, borrowing money is actually really, really cheap because the interest rates are so low.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not contesting the policy. It sounds a little bit risky to me because, I mean, sure, that might cover you for the planned renovation, but then what happens if an earthquake hits and you suddenly double the amount that you're... So but anyway, that's their policy. So yeah. I just want to say that it's not necessarily a bad sign if the reserve fund is depleted, because sometimes it's just because the building fees have been left low for as long as possible. And the other thing is that you'll find that there's a bit of a difference between buildings where most of the units are investment size units, and others are family sized units, which are usually going to be owned by owners occupiers. Investors, and again, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because most of our customers are the same. When investors buy a property, and you know, all of these studio 1R, 1DK, they're never going to live in them. They're basically investment properties from the get-go. So when they buy one of these, they've in their mind already know that they're going to resell it after 10, 15 years, right? So they really don't have any long-term interest in keeping the building up to spec, you know? All they care about is minimizing their monthly fees and maximizing their yield. So we, on behalf of our clients, usually just vote for the lowest fee hike as possible, because we're not thinking what happens in 20 years. We're thinking in 5-7 years when we resell. We want the yield to be as high as possible, because that's how these properties are priced, based on yield, right? Whereas with owners occupiers, they have a lot, they're going to be there for the long haul, and they're obviously enjoying the perks of a nice building. So they usually would have more interest in keeping things, you know, as beautiful and tidy and well maintained as possible. So it's a bit of a different mindset depending on the size of the property. So if you're looking at 2, 3, 4 LDK, then you're probably going to find that the buildings are normally better maintained than those tiny shoeboxes.
Yeah. Oh, look, I used to go and spend a lot of time up in Onjuku in Chiba, and in one of those apartments that was on the water there, and you know, people
probably stayed at the same one.
Sorry?
We probably stayed at the same one. Probably. Sea Heights?
The one with the really hideous orange, like, lobby. And, I mean, it was a really good location. It was great. And some of those apartments were really good and the prices were great, but you know, they were notorious for having really, you know, having zero sinking fund, and even along, I'm just looking at the outside on the balconies, you could actually see rebar coming through. And I was like, well, you know, this doesn't actually feel so safe. What, you know, if this falls down, I've got, you know, zero land rights and I've got zero, you know, it's like I've just lost it. So
in some cases, also Japan being Japan, it doesn't happen that often, or at least not as often as in other countries. But in some cases, there's actual mismanagement and embezzlement, and those things happen here as well.
Yes, it does.
If you see on the building, like the annual meetings by the owner union, you might suddenly see, oh, we've replaced the management company 3 years ago because they weren't doing anything, or they were pocketing some of the money and doing other things with it. And it's usually a good sign. It means that they, you know, they've taken action.
Mm-hmm.
But
Just quickly, the point that you made before about, you know, difference between owner occupiers, so properties that are largely owner occupied, so 2LDK, 3LDK, where most of the mansion is resided by the owners, then yeah, they, because they live there, they tend to spend more on the maintenance and they're happy to do that. Whereas the investment side of it, the smaller places, they want to keep the management fees low, and because it's purely a ROI. So for investors, that's one way of looking at it. I look at it exactly the other side of the same coin. Is I tell people when we're looking, I go, this is largely owner occupied. Like we check with the management company. That's an attractive sales point.
Absolutely.
Because when people are buying it, they're like, you know, they want to buy for, you know, they want to live there. And so they're comfortable knowing that everyone else is going to care about the building. Right. So it's also a positive sales item is when it is largely owner occupied. And we look at the buildings. If someone wants a 3LDK and they find a place, it's the penthouse of the building, 3LDK, and every other apartment is a one bedroom, small one bedroom. I tell them, look, you want to live here with your you want to live here with your family, right? And you have like, let's think of two types of buildings. One where everyone is a one LDK and you're the only person with a three bedroom family apartment. The kind of people living in that building are different to, hey, this entire building is all 2 and 3 LDK.
That's a very good point.
Mostly families.
The neighbors are totally different, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, right? The people in. So, and you kind of get to know your neighbors, get to know the community. So that's relevant in mansions. So you want to see, like, if you're buying the biggest mansion, the biggest, you know, apartment in the whole building, that may not really, like, the culture and the style of people that are there may be a bit of a mismatch. Or, like, if it's just a little bit bigger, 50 square meters and then 65, and you're still a single person, yeah, that makes sense. But when it's really a massive change, well, that's something you need to keep in mind. And the same goes for some houses. Sometimes you see a beautiful house, and it's a nice big house on its own, but all the neighboring properties, it's like these are just old apartment, wooden apartment. And it's like, you know, maybe the rent is 45,000 yen for each apartment. It's just a little one room. So it's like, hold on, this whole street is people that are not families. Mm-hmm. Whereas often we go, look, it's lovely. Like it's 8 new houses being developed. Every person buying this house is going to be a young family just like yourself, mm-hmm. right? Or if it's like, you know, the entire street. So that's something we also look at. And depending on the kind of client, you know, that's a really, really important point. They may want like that thing where they're just individual and they don't want to be amongst kids and families. They're you know, a single couple or just a single person versus, you know, someone with a family, they want the whole entire family environment. So that's very something that I pay close attention to. Most of my clients are families. So I always let them know when I'm like, what I sort of spot out, like, oh, that's an apartment over there. That's an apartment. This is an apartment. And there are no other houses in the area. I'm like, I'm not getting a good vibe from area.
Tracy, that's something that your customers need to take into consideration too, I guess, right? Like if somebody's thinking about setting up a Minpaku operation, even if the city ward says it's okay in this area, but everywhere around them is like family homes, they're going to have some trouble, aren't they?
Well, yes, but usually if it's pure residential, if it's like Residential A, you won't get the Minpaku license anyway. I mean, you know, but in my street, I've got all family homes in my street and I have a hotel license, but I'm on a commercial, we're on a commercial zone, but my neighbours are really cool, so they're all really cool, so, they... You know, they're totally fine because they know me. You know, I'm like, I don't just come in, you know, bring any old Yahoo into the area. I'm like a really strict host. It's like not all Minpaku is built, hosts are built the same. Yeah. And so, you know, you can have a really, really bad Airbnb host who's vacant and doesn't look after their guests very well. And then the guests are just running amok. Or you have, you know, hands-on hosts like me, who are also in it for the long run. I live in the area, so it's like I want the best as well.
Yeah, one thing, like But if someone's looking to just buy, like there was a question on Facebook, on the Japan Real Estate Facebook group as well recently about if I want to buy a whole building, right? I'm looking for an agent. Someone said, I'm looking for an agent to buy an entire building to use for minpaku or a hotel. You know, like, yes, if it's in a residential area, if it's in the right zoning, you can technically build it and you can turn it into a hotel, and you've got to be more cautious.
Did you tag me in that post? I didn't see it, you know.
We did tag you, actually, I think.
Did I respond?
I don't think you did, no.
Yeah. So anyway, okay. Go on, Emil.
But in terms of that, but, you know, but if someone's looking, like, if someone's looking for a hotel, basically an old house to turn into a hotel or a block of land to build a hotel, if there are two options and they're the same price, one is in the, like, down some residential area amongst a bunch of houses, like, technically you can do it, versus one is, like, on the short end guy, right? Just amongst a bunch of, you're like, straight away, yep, this is great. I'm going to have no headache from the neighbors, right? This is going to be so crazy. So, yes, you can get away with it. And yeah, you can pull it off and do it. And it's a bit, you know, you got to be a little bit more cautious and of the neighbors and considerate of the environment. But wow, if you find one on the show, thing guy, that's like almost a free pass because you're like, yeah, that this is so good. So
I'd love to have a place on a show, thing guy. It'd be awesome.
Yeah, and because like it's easy access.
Just for our listeners who are not familiar with the term, can you explain what a shotengai is?
So shotengai is the shopping street. So often when you get out of the station, there'll be just a few strips coming out of the station, and you just walk down, and there's like convenience stores and dry cleaners and dentists all along either side of it, and that's like basically commercial sort of zoning area. And they sort of scatter out as you get away from the station. But having a house on that or a hotel or a short-term stay property on one of those areas, because there's so much foot traffic, neighbors, there's no immediate like neighbors. Kids don't really play on the street. Cars don't really drive up and down there so much. It's not so quiet. It's expected to be noisy. There's restaurants. So you're not going to have issues about neighbors complaining about people dragging their suitcases. Oh, it's too noisy, etc. Or who are all these strange people walking up and down? You know, if it's around the shopping street, that's like an open, you know, shopping area for anyone to come and go. So it's a great, you know, or just straight off that, really easy, that a place where it's not going to disturb neighbors, being like ordinary families. That's the ticket. So when someone in that Facebook group was saying, you know, they're looking to buy a place that they can do for short term stay, or get a minpaku Airbnb type license. I said to them, my response in that post was, you should be getting a property that you can get a hotel license for. And it's not like what's the cheapest one that I can get the max ROI, because there's always that thing of what's ROI versus management, maintenance, and headache. And if it's, you know, Tracy can tell you, like, you said you'd love it. If someone has it, you know, even 10 minutes from the station, but if it's on a shotengai on a strip where there's not going to be any trouble with the neighbors, often it's easy access from the station. The map is going to be one straight road or maybe one right turn. And you're right there. You don't have to go and help lost people find their way. That's the comfortable, easy one that I think is worth paying a premium for. Mm-hmm. And you're just going to have a really well-run operation.
Yeah, look, I had one client who was in the process of building I was helping him build a capsule hotel on a shotengai. And he had the building and he was doing all the renos and, you know, the builders were in there and they'd like gutted everything. And then the pandemic hit and it was just like, oh my goodness.
Speaking of that, Tracy, are you, now that we're slowly opening up to more business travelers and students, are you seeing any uptick?
I got 3 new bookings today. Yes. First, you know, I'm very, very upbeat because I've got 3 new bookings. Well, it's actually 3, not, well, it was 1 yesterday and 2 today that brand new. They're not for the next, you know, minute, but people are booking again. I'm very excited. I have my clients who are actually due to arrive in March. They actually have a confirmed arrival date of the 3rd of April. So they're in. So these are people that have booked with me before. They're coming in, but I still have vacancies. So
yeah, no, I'm sure you do, but I'm wondering if things are slightly improving.
Look at my face. Look at my face. Look at my face. I'm much, much happier. But Emil, I had another follow-up question before from the first round before you had to drop off. If somebody is looking
keep,
for...
Keep talking.
Keep talking. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
okay. Let's say somebody is changing jobs, and they've up until a certain point have been self-employed or freelance or whatever. They've then taken a job with a big corporate with a big name and a like fancy, you know, how long does it take for the bank to recognize, like, to yeah, you know, to see recognize. Them as a, see them as a good like candidate?
To consider the employment, depends on the bank, depends on the situation, but the shortest you get is one payslip.
One payslip. So yeah. If you then go and work for, like, you know, like you go and work for Coca-Cola, or like you go from being freelance, from being a, you know, not saying me, but someone like me who's like been, you know, been running their own business, self-employed. If I go and get a job tomorrow at a corporate that has a big name, I just have to go one payslip and they see me as a completely different animal. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a certain type of bank with a certain type of loan. So yes, but you need to meet a few other criteria. So the shortest will be 1 month. Realistically, they often work. There's a thing in Japan called shiokikan. So probation period.
Right.
So in Japan, in Japan, often the probation period is 3 months, maybe 6 months. Okay. So the probation period for listeners is when it's easy for the company to cancel your contract or to fire you. Right. But outside of that, it becomes very hard for permanent employees to get fired, for companies to let them go in Japan. Right.
So surely that would be on your employment contract. Like some people would get employed without that 3 months.
Yeah. So actually,
in general, an executive level.
No. So it can be two or three ways. They can say the employment period is 3 months, or the probation period is 3 months, probation period is 6 months. Or they say it can specify that there is no probation period, or there is nothing discussed about probation period at all. My understanding is if there's nothing mentioned about probation period, then the standard is 3 months, right? Even if it's not explicitly stated, then 3 months is how it is what the like Ministry of Affairs, Ministry of Labor will kind of consider it. What I've heard, I don't know about it. But again, we're just talking a few months, right? So rather than nitpicking about, ooh, this or that, let's say it's 3 months. Right?
It's not 2 years worth of,
Yes and no. So it does vary on case by case. But if you look at just at the employment, if you meet some other criteria, it could be 1 month. Otherwise, it will be some banks will work just 1 month after the end of the probation period. So just say it's a 3 month probation period, your fourth paycheck. So it'll be often salaries paid on the 25th of every month in Japan. So the 25th of the fourth month, when you have that payslip, that's when they'll accept your application. Some other banks are 3 months after the end of your probation period. So if you're on a 3 month probation period, then it's on the 6 month payslip. If it's on a 6 month probation period, then it's on the 9 month payslip. There's a bunch of factors, but depending on your individual situation, you may or may not be eligible to apply for the 1 month version bank or the 3 month bank or the 6 month bank. You may have to do it for the later one. Mm. And there are some banks that you can do it right away, but if you've been there for under 2 years, they don't tell you, but they will recalculate your borrowing capacity a little bit lower.
That goes for refinancing too. So for example,
maybe your interest rate a little bit higher too.
Sometimes, like, you know, like they'll say it'll either be like they don't play with the interest rate so much, maybe sometimes a little bit. And look, I'm speaking specifically for home loans, your own personal home loan. Investment loans, I'm not too sure about. Then when they analyze the the interest rate, there could be a 0.2% decrease. It's like the super low risk person, which is like 0.45%, or the not super low risk person, which is 0.65%, right? It'll be like either of those kind of two triggers. So yes, you can do it, you can get it, but it depends on the bank and your other situation. If you have permanent residency, and the employer you are going with is a listed company, it's a large company. Okay, like Sony is my example of a typical big, large Japanese company, right? You get a job at Sony.
Google, Amazon, Sony, whatever, employer. Yeah.
Any listed company, right? And then in terms of your age as well, how look at it, how much you want to borrow, what your existing debt is. And then also stuff like, to be honest, like your family situation. A single guy in his, 20s, they're going to say, if they don't have permanent residency, you just change over. Look, we can give you the loan, but we want you to pay 20% deposit, because you can just, if you get a good, better job in Singapore, you can just leave. Versus any of us married with kids in the system.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh yeah, we don't have the same kind of flexibility. Flexibility is just jump ship. So they know, okay, yeah, the chance of this guy just getting a better job and picking up his old family on a whim next week. We do that in our 20s. We don't do that in our, 30s and 40s and 50s. And especially if we've got kids or not, if you're married or not. So they do look at that as well. So yeah, it's a bit of a case by case kind of situation. But if you have permanent residency and you get a job with a company, three to 6 months is we can realistically look at it. And my clients will, when I do most of my clients, they'll reach out either through they'll see this, or they hear this podcast, or they see the video, the blog, or they see me on Facebook, or it's a referral. They'll send me an email and say, Emil, look, I want to talk. I'm interested in buying. Can we discuss my situation? And I'll schedule like a 1 hour phone call. Usually it ends up being 1 hour to 90 minutes, and discuss really their specific situation, their requirements. And from that, it's like, okay, based on what you're telling me, I kind of feel these banks would be the best ones, but everyone's always a unique kind of case. So I'll get their data, their information, and then I'll just call our banks, because we have the loan officers assigned to our agency. We're a typical Japanese agency. And so I'll call, Mizuho, MUFJ, Rizona, and SMBC, and say, this is the client that I've got. This is their situation. They just changed jobs. This is their new company. This is their current income. This is what they were doing before. They've been employed for 2 months. What can we do? What can we expect? And how long do you want? And they'll say, maybe we want them to be, 6 months in the company. I'll like, well, actually, no, this person looks pretty solid. They went from one listed company to another listed company, okay, with no break in between. The income's pretty much similar, or everything, all the story makes sense. They have permanent residency. Yeah, okay, yeah, this person can apply right away.
Yeah.
We get that feedback, and I find the bank which will do the best financing deal and the most easiest and the soonest for the client. But also keep in mind, it generally takes, the search takes about 3 months at least once you're active and engaged to find the right one. Mm-hmm. So you don't really need the one that's on month one.
Mm. Interesting. Well, no, thank you for that. No, that's
we can talk separately.
There's some people doing some interesting things lately. I think, with the business people still being locked out, I think a lot of like long-termers are making some interesting career choices while they can. So, it's definitely. That's not just if people in this podcast are listening in Japan, there are some, if you've been thinking about taking a job. There's a lot of, now is a really good time because they're hungry for talent.
They
can't bring people in. They're hungry for talent. And then there's all these additional benefits, like Emil has just said, about your borrowing capacity. If you're really keen on setting down roots here, then now is once in a lifetime, hopefully once in a lifetime opportunity to do that.
We had enough of this.
But one more thing, if you're considering buying a house and changing job, let's jump on the
Buy a house first?
Buy a house first, yeah. But buy the house first before changing your job.
What about if you're working as a freelancer and you don't, like...
Because that's not changing job, right? That's getting a job. But if you're a salaried employee right now, and you've been at the same company for 12 years...
Now is a good time to get the house,
and then you're like... Yeah, you're like, oh, my wife's pregnant. I'm going to get married. I'm going to think, oh, hey, you know, I'm also, let me start. I want to buy a house, but also let me consider a career change. And I'm like, well, yeah, okay, let's buy a house first.
I totally see that. But I'm just saying is, you know, there's a lot of people who have been like doing freelance teaching, whatever. If they go and then get a corporate job or a university job, which they can, do that first, and then you'll be able to have more buying, you know, real estate opportunities. All right.
That's a good note to end on.
I think it is.
Oh, but Tracy, before we go, could you, all of those cheap-ass ski resort properties that you're looking at, could you just send me a copy of those links? I got a customer looking for exactly that at the moment.
No problem. I can do that. Looking at a 3LDK for under $10,000, I'm like, tempting.
Steve, before we wrap up, can you tell us about your new company, please?
Yes.
Oh, so
yes,
you post goodness. Something, yes. And I'm like, hey,
yes.
Good stuff.
Yep. So the company is called Nippon Bridge. Maybe in the future it'll be part of the Nippon Group, but at the moment it's a separate company.
And so, is that in Japanese? Is it Nihonbashi?
Yeah, so no, we're specifically not calling it anything in Japanese. It's Nippon Bridge.
Oh, stop it, Emil. See, look, if you don't speak Japanese...
Three kids.
Oh, no, that's Sami.
And what we're doing is, at the moment, we're two-pronged. So one side is, I think I might have mentioned here on the podcast once or twice, what we're going to do is same as we're doing with real estate, we're going to help foreign investors buy into Japanese franchise businesses. So your curry shops, your bento box places, Hotomoto, or after school.
Coin laundries?
Laundries is something we're definitely looking at. So what we do is basically, we have a few case studies that we're already acting on, but if somebody has a particular interest in a particular kind of business, we're definitely happy to search for franchises who would consider foreign investors.
So many good franchises here. Yes. I've got friends who are doing like...
And they don't know how to work with foreign investors. So we're very happy to help them with that.
So many good franchises. Yeah, like a friend of mine, they bought into a cleaning franchise. And, you know... Cleaning franchise business.
Cleaning are a big one, yeah.
Cleaning air conditioners, and it's great. The support from the franchise, you know, head office is outstanding.
Yes. So for anybody who's interested in investing in a business, this is obviously investing in a business is a bit of a higher risk than investing in like rental real estate, for example. But as businesses go, working with a franchise is a much lower risk factor because they've got the blueprint, they've done it successfully, they hold your hand throughout the process, tell you how to hire, they do the training of the staff for you, everything. And the other advantage of that is that it is much, much easier to get a business visa for somebody who's seeking to relocate to Japan, because to get a business visa via property investment, you need to have some pretty hefty property assets, right?
Yeah.
And these are cheap. They're cheap to get into for the price of a property, right? A cheap property, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. You can have a business up and running and guarantee yourself a business visa in the process. And the other prong of the business is affordable relocation services. So there are obviously quite a few companies doing relocation services, assisting people who are coming to Japan with housing, opening a bank account, registering kids for school, signing up for utilities and so forth. But they cost a fortune. They cost about $600 a day at a minimum for a day of support.
Well, they geared at corporates, though. They're geared at the big multinationals.
Exactly.
So the average small to medium business?
Exactly. Yeah. So what we're planning to do is to start offering the service to people who actually need it but can't afford it. So university, faculty, maybe international students, English teachers. We believe we can do that for at least half that price. So that's what we're going to be doing. Those two things.
Genius. And just in Fukuoka or countrywide?
The relocation service, because it requires a lot of hand-holding, like physical attendance, we're going to start it not just Fukuoka, but Kyushu. So anywhere in Kyushu, there's a lot of people relocating to Kitakyushu, to Kumamoto, to Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. But once we've got, you know, the expertise and a few clients under our belt, we're definitely planning to do it Japan-wide as well. Yeah, via outsourcing or any branch office or so sort.
No, look, I've done training. Uh-huh. I've actually been the trainer on a lot of those inbounds before and done the cross-cultural training, so...
Yep. So if we need work done in and around Tokyo, you can definitely do that, right?
Count me in.
Here you go. Perfect.
Yep. Giddy up, man.
Cool. So good stuff. The
franchise
good.
Business is already going. We've got two customers who are already in the process of establishing their first franchisee operation. The relocation business, it's established, but there's not too many people relocating still. So the infrastructure is in place, but we still need the borders to open a little bit more for that.
Alrighty, that sounds great.
Fantastic.
Congratulations. Well, if
Thank
I hear
you. People... So there's going to be a new podcast, a new YouTube channel, a lot of articles coming out. Everything that you've seen on the Japan real estate front is going to be replicated on the Nippon Bridge front as well.
Oh, that's awesome. Nippon Bridge, Nihonbashi. All day. I'm going to be bothered by that all day now, Emil.
That's my intention. Make people uncomfortable. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much. Have
Good
a wonderful
speak with you again,
wonderful
folks.
Day.
See you again very, very soon.
Done, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So there you have it. Nippon Bridge, a new company, is off. Really exciting stuff. Feel free to reach out if you want to find out more. As mentioned, the website, social media channels, podcast or podcasts and YouTube channel or channels all coming soon. And of course, if you have any questions about the other topics we were discussing there as well, don't be shy. Drop us a line. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.